just how old is mankind, and how did he evolve, or how did he, according to Michael Cremo, devolve? Michael Cremo is next on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo, member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, and the European Association of Archaeologists. He's also a research associate in history and philosophy of science for the Bhaktivedanta Institute. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with spirituality from the Eastern tradition. Our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Michael Cremo. Hey, Michael, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be with you, George, and with all your listeners.
Always a pleasure. I just love this topic with you, Michael. And, you know, the more I get into it, the more I realize, you know, I think you're right. I think mankind might have been around much longer than people think. Why has modern science, anthropology especially, why has it aged man not as old as what you believe we to be?
Well, I believe it's because they favor a purely materialistic explanation of how human beings and other life forms came into existence. You know, they believe that maybe 2 billion years ago there were just chemicals floating around the Earth's ocean, and they believe that somehow or other these chemicals combined together to form the first single-celled organism, and then they think somehow or other those single-celled organisms began to combine with each other and form multicellular organisms, and gradually some of them became fish, and then some of them walked up on the land and became amphibians and reptiles and primitive mammals, and some of those mammals became apes and monkeys and went into the trees, and then some of them came down out of the trees and became ape men like Australopithecus, and finally some of those ape men became human beings like us. And they want to explain human existence in a purely materialistic way, that we're just an accident of evolution. There's no real purpose to human life. We're just chemical machines in competition with other chemical machines for survival. And this generates a very materialistic concept of life, so that most people today believe that the main purpose in life is to simply produce and consume more and more material things, which generates a lot of wealth, and that wealth flows into a lot of pockets, including those of scientists who are inventing weapons of mass destruction, all kinds of destructive drugs and chemicals, all kinds of useless consumer products. And that money also goes into the pockets of governments who are taxing all that economic activity. The military likes it that they're getting so many weapons from the scientists. Industrialists like it that they're getting so many consumer products and drugs and pharmaceuticals that they can sell. So I think there's a whole system that's at stake here, not just the idea, you know, that humans are 100,000 years old. That fits into a whole system that focuses our consciousness on the purely material aspects of life, which forces us into certain patterns of activity that are benefiting certain people in society, and they want to keep things like that way. And this idea, you know, that human beings are purely materialistic products, that we're just another kind of animal, just another kind of ape, is a key to that. Because if we had a different set of answers to these fundamental questions, who are we, where did we come from, I think it would lead in a more spiritual direction. We would begin to question, well, where does consciousness come from? How could that result from a combination of chemicals? It would make us more aware of each other as coming from the same source. It would kind of end the conflict and competition that lies at the basis of today's political and economic systems. So I think there's a lot riding on the answers to these questions, and I think that's why they want to keep these ideas intact. Because they're the key to the whole pattern of culture, economics, and politics that we've got in the the world today.
If you had an opportunity to talk with Charles Darwin, if you lived when he lived, you had your theories, he had his, what would you tell him, Michael? How would you switch him over?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. Some people tell me maybe I'm a reincarnation of Charles Darwin. I've had to take birth again to correct my mistake. But, you know, actually, I have a bit of respect for Charles Darwin because I think he's somewhat different than the people who have taken over his philosophy today and turned it into an ideology. You know, he was a very interesting person. He left university. You know, he didn't have a PhD. He didn't finish his undergraduate degree. He was trained, actually, in theology. That's what he was trained in. That's what he was studying at university. And he went on a voyage on the Beagle, and he came to certain ideas about evolution. But I think he was a genuine scientist in this sense, that I think he would have been prepared to change his ideas. He admitted that there were some problems with his theories. For example, he admitted that the fossil record really didn't support his theories. He admitted that.
And then he began to believe in God, too, didn't he?
Well,
divine,
yes,
creator?
Actually,
yeah.
in the second, his book, Origin of Species, went into 6 editions. In the first edition, he didn't say too much about God, but in the second edition, he said, in describing his theory, there's grandeur in this view of life where, in the beginning, the Creator, with a capital C, breathed life into one or a few kinds of organisms and let the rest evolve. Now, there are 2 things that he says there, one of which I agree with and one of which I don't agree with. The first is that some creator with a capital C, some kind of cosmic intelligence, was involved in the origin of life, which he says directly in his book. And it's a big embarrassment to many of the evolutionists today who want to take God completely out of the picture. So it's a big embarrassment to them. But I agree with that part of what he said. I don't believe in his theory of evolution that he outlines in the rest of the book. But I think he was a reasonable person. I think that if it was pointed out to him that after 150 years, because he wrote his book Origin of Species 150 years ago, it was published in 1859, and I think if he were able to come today and see after 150 years that so much fossil evidence has accumulated that contradicts his theory, I think he might be willing to change it. But for many of his supporters today, his theory of evolution is not so much a scientific idea, but an ideology which cannot be questioned. It's people like that who try to, you know, his supporters today who aren't willing to listen to evidence that contradicts their theories, who have tried to enforce a government, who have now a government-enforced monopoly so that their ideas only can be taught in the education systems in most countries in the world, including the United States, who really object to what I'm saying. I don't think Darwin himself would object to what I'm saying. I think he'd listen, and I think he would be willing to change his ideas in the face of evidence. But many of his supporters today, they don't want to hear evidence that contradicts the theory. They try to suppress that evidence. They try to restrict those who want to speak about this evidence. For example, a couple of months ago, I was in Russia. My book, Human Devolution, was published there. And I went on an 8-city tour. And one of the cities, Yaroslavl, some scientists, professors at a university there, had invited me to speak.
Okay.
And at the last moment, the president of the university canceled the lecture because of pressure from outside organizations who objected to me being opposed to the Darwinian
theory. Really? In Russia?
Oh, yes. Being opposed to the theory of Darwinian evolution, and because also I have a spiritual perspective on these things coming from the Vedas. They objected to that as well.
Sure. We got to get into Vedas later. That's a fascinating
series. But what happened was really very interesting. The The president of the university canceled the lecture, but the professors arranged for me to speak in an auditorium right next to the university. And when it came time for the lecture, it was packed with hundreds of students and professors from the university. And the professors who organized the lecture said it was probably more people came to hear me after the lecture was canceled, you know, by the university president than would have come if the lecture had gone on as scheduled, you know, at the university itself. So you get that kind of opposition from those who have taken, you know, this Darwinian theory of evolution, not just as some scientific idea that could be proved or disproved, but as an ideology, practically a new religion that can't be challenged.
Okay, now I'm not going to ask you yet about the possibility of us being genetically altered by those above, but if we did not evolve from apes, how did this progression of us occur? I mean, did we just start? I mean, what happened here?
Well, I mean, people began to ask me that question after they read the book Forbidden Archaeology, where I present all this archaeological evidence that shows human beings have existed for tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years, going right back to the beginning of the history of life on Earth. And, of course, that evidence contradicts, you know, the standard Darwinian theory that, you know, we evolved from more primitive ape-like creatures, and before that there were just simple mammals, and before that reptiles, before that fish, before that just chemicals. So people began to ask, okay, if you don't think we evolved from the apes, then where did we come from? And I tried to answer that question in my latest book, Human Devolution. But what I proposed there is that before we even ask that question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? I mean, we should know what it is we're trying to explain. Now, today, many scientists are going to say, well, we're just a combination of chemicals. That's what a human being is. But I propose that if we carefully look at all the evidence that comes to us from science, we're going to see it's more reasonable to say that a human being is a combination of three things. Ordinary matter, chemicals, yes, that's part of what a human being is. But beyond that, there's a subtle mind substance with very unusual powers of telepathy, telekinesis, all kinds of strange powers. And then beyond that, there is a conscious self that can exist completely apart from the body. And this suggests to me that we exist in a multi-level cosmos where we have one level dominated by ordinary matter, another level dominated by these more subtle elements inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there, and then beyond that, a level of pure consciousness. And that's where I think we start out. We start out as beings of pure consciousness. And if we depart from that level, and we could talk about the reasons for that, but if we depart from that level, then we need a vehicle. Just like as human beings, we're normally meant to live on the land. So if we want to go into an alien element like water, we need a vehicle that will allow us to function there. We need a submarine or a diving suit or something like that. So when a pure conscious self comes down to this level of ordinary matter, it needs a vehicle, a body that will allow it to function there. And there are different kinds of bodies. There are bodies of plants, animals, human beings, ape men, apes and monkeys. So those vehicles are, I believe, designed by higher intelligences to allow a conscious self to function in different ways in the realm of matter where we find ourselves now. So that's where I think the human form came from. I think it's designed to allow a conscious self to function in a certain way in the realm of matter. But different conscious selves have different desires, so they get different vehicles.
Well, and that makes sense. That at least gives us a foundation here for why we are. And, well, you know what? It's not a bad theory, Michael.
Well, I think it's pretty rational in the sense that, I mean, we all have something to do with vehicles. Where do vehicles come from? Where do our cars come from? Well, why do we have cars? Well, we have cars because there are people who understand that there are people, there are conscious beings who want to move around in certain ways, so they design different kinds of vehicles for them. Some people, they prefer to drive around in cars. Some people want to fly around in airplanes. Some people want to ride on the water in boats. Some people want to go under the water in submarines. So you've got companies, intelligent people with engineers and designers who design different kinds of vehicles for different kinds of people who have different needs, different incomes, different tastes. And it's the most it's very obvious. We see it all around us. So I think it's not too far of a stretch to imagine that there are higher kinds of engineers existing at higher levels of the cosmos who are capable of designing vehicles for conscious selves to function in, such as bodies of human beings, bodies of ape men, bodies of apes and monkeys, bodies of plants and animals. I do think there is a kind of evolution. And that would be the evolution of the conscious self through the different kinds of vehicles or bodies in the course of reincarnation.
If mankind is indeed hundreds of millions of years older than most people and most scientists believe, does that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that we did not evolve in the Darwinian way?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I deliberately, in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, did not propose any alternative theory. I just put the evidence that contradicts the current theory because I wanted people to be free to think about this and come up with their own explanations. And I saved my own personal idea, my own personal alternative idea for another book that I wrote, Human Devolution. But people have proposed all kinds of things. They've proposed perhaps a new theory of evolution where human beings evolved much earlier than scientists now think possible. Some have proposed that human beings came to Earth from outer space, you know, the extraterrestrial idea, or they've proposed various kinds of extraterrestrial interventions in the history of life on Earth. And they've even proposed time travelers as a way to explain this evidence, people coming from the future into the past. So there are a lot of different ideas out there, and I think that's healthy. I think it is really healthy that people are thinking about a lot of different alternative ideas. And I've offered my idea, this human devolution idea, namely that the conscious self descends from some higher level of the cosmos and it's embodied in a certain way. And the purpose of human life is really to go back, you know, to that original level of pure consciousness or spirit, if you like that word. But I think it's really healthy that people are thinking about this in different ways, and I encourage them to do that.
Michael, we'll continue, of course, talking about human devolution, but of course, one of the first steps is Forbidden Archaeology and also your original book, The Hidden History of the Human Race, where you have described some truly incredible, absolutely remarkable stories where you prove that mankind could be around for hundreds of millions of years. So when we come right back with Michael Cremo, we'll get into that. I mean, some of these stories are absolutely riveting. Michael's websites are located and linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. We'll be right back with him, Michael Cremo. And our special guest, Michael Cremo, lots more with Michael Cremo. By the way, the After Dark newsletter is available to you. You get 13 issues for the price of 12. All you have to do to order is call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. We're with Michael Cremo. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Michael, what evidence, what things are out there that have led you to believe that mankind could be hundreds and hundreds of millions of years old?
Well, there's the reports in the different scientific journals of the past 150 years that show that scientists all over the world have discovered human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints that are many, many millions of years old. I mean, we could start out with some of the oldest ones.
Sure.
For example, there was a scientific journal called The Geologist. You know, it's published here in the United States. It told in an article published in the year 1862 that a human skeleton was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County in the state of Illinois. And according to this report, above the skeleton was a thick layer of slate rock that was unbroken. And that's an important detail because it means the skeleton cannot have come down from some higher, more recent level. And the report also said that there were medical doctors present who examined the bones and said that they were of the human type. They weren't any kind of ape man or any other kind of animal. They were physically of the human type. Now, we got in touch with geologists of the state of Illinois, and we asked them, well, how old is that layer below the slate rock at that place? We didn't tell them what was found there, because if we told them a human skeleton had been found, they might have just not answered, you know, the letter.
Right.
So we very carefully described the location, the formations that were there, and they said the age of the formation below the slate rock at that place is about 300 million years, which is, you know, before, you know, the time of the dinosaurs even. So there you have a human skeleton found in layers of rock about 300 million years old with no possibility at all that the skeleton could have come down from some higher, more recent level. And we could also consider the case of the shoe print, you know, that was found near Antelope Springs, Utah, by William Meister. And he found that in the year 1968. He was a researcher, a collector of fossils, and he was breaking open pieces of slate rock at this place, Antelope Spring. And when he broke open one piece of rock, he found a shoe print. You know, my co-author, Richard Thompson, went to visit William Meister in Utah, and he was able to see this specimen. He was able to take photographs of it, and we did a computer analysis, and we showed that the shape of this impression in the rock is exactly like that of a shoe print. And if you look at your shoe, at the bottom of the shoe, you can usually see where your heel is worn down
mm-hmm.
in a certain place.
Yep.
So this print had that same feature in it. And also crushed in the middle of the footprint was a fossil of a trilobite. Now, a trilobite is a kind of shellfish that existed about 500 million years ago in what's called the Cambrian period. So, okay, we've got human skeletons that are hundreds of millions of years old. We have a human shoe print that is hundreds of millions of years old. And then we also have various human artifacts that are hundreds of millions of years old. Probably the oldest are the round metallic
spheres. This is a great story. Yeah, go ahead.
That come from South Africa, from a mine at a place called Otosdal in the western Transvaal region. And these objects are about 1 or 2 inches in diameter. They have parallel grooves that go around the center of each one of them. They're made of a kind of iron called hematite, which is considered even today to be a semi-precious stone. You can go to jewelry stores and buy jewelry made of hematite. So they're very interesting objects. Metallurgists who've examined them say they can't explain how they could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth, especially the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. And to me, that suggests, well, there must have been someone with human-like intelligence that manufactured these things, but they're found in layers of rock over 2 billion years old, which to me is really quite amazing. So you've got cases of human artifacts, hundreds of millions of years old, human skeletons, hundreds of millions of years old, human footprints or shoe prints, hundreds of millions of years old. And then it doesn't stop there. These discoveries continue into more recent times as well. And we could talk about more of them if you like.
Yeah, we will. And Michael, do we know or can you even deduce what the technology or intelligence factor might have been of these humans millions of years ago? I mean, where are the buildings? Where are the computers? Where are the cars? Where are the airplanes?
Well, I think what I've discovered is just the tip of the iceberg, really. But what we're talking about when we consider the kinds of questions that you're asking is, what is the level of civilization of these humans? What was the level of their culture? What was the level of their technology? But whether we're talking about human beings of high culture or high technology or low technology, the very first thing is human beings like us have to be present. And I think I've demonstrated at least that. And then to go on further, you know, to look at the history of these people over these vast periods of time, the different levels of culture and technology that they had, I think is a topic for future research.
Sure.
But you do get some interesting hints of things. For example, there was a case in the United States, and again in the state of Illinois, where they were drilling an artesian well. They had gone down about 200 feet, and they brought up a copper object that appeared to be some kind of coin. It was a round copper object. On one side, there was a human figure, some human figures, and some unknown script. And as I said, it came from a place in Illinois called Lawn Ridge, over 100 feet deep. And in the original report, which comes from a researcher from the Smithsonian Institution, a man named William Dubois, he gave the drilling record, you know, that at this place, you know, you go down through 10 feet of yellow clay, 44 feet of blue clay, et cetera, et cetera. So we gave that drilling record to some geologists of the state of Illinois, and we asked them, how old are the deposits at the level that the coin came up from? Of course, we didn't mention the coin, because that would tip them off and probably cause them not to answer our question. But we just asked them, how old is the formation at that level? It was about, they said between 200,000 and 400,000 years old. Now, that's kind of amazing because, according to standard histories, coins did not come into existence until about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago in Asia Minor, in what's now Turkey, a country called Lydia. And to have this kind of evidence at over 200,000 years really is very amazing, because if you have a coin, that means you had to have some kind of government system. You had to have some kind of economic system going on. So that was pretty amazing. And I think, you know, if we're going to talk about other things, for example, well, maybe millions of years ago, people had laptop computers, for example.
But if that technology had evolved, I mean, because you're right. Even if mankind, let's say, was 100 or 200 million years older than what we are now, it's very possible that they didn't have the kind of technology that I thought they would with their devolution.
Yes, I mean, that's possible. We have to consider that even just in recent history.
Then again, we could have had civilizations with incredible abilities, as we'll talk about when we get into the Vedas, of course. But what do you think might have happened before we get into also some of these other cases? What do you think, even if mankind 200 million years ago stayed at a relatively primitive, like 1000 BC type person, what happened to them? Was there a calamity that wiped them out?
To me, the evidence suggests that there have been periodic catastrophes that have devastated the Earth, after which the Earth has had to have been repopulated. And this is something that, well, the Greek philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, said in their writings, that human civilizations have come and gone many times in the history of the Earth. It's something that the Vedas also say, that human civilizations have come and gone many times in the history of life on Earth. And actually, these ancient Sanskrit writings go even further. They describe that there have been six major devastations in the history of life on Earth in the course of cyclical time. They say we're now in the kind of the seventh cycle, and before that there have been six cycles. And between each of these cycles, which are called manvantars, there have been devastations after which the Earth has had to have been repopulated. And it's interesting, I find, that according to modern paleontology, they say there have been six major extinction events in the history of life on Earth, the most recent being the catastrophe that wiped out the dinosaurs when they say some asteroid struck the Earth and caused a lot of devastation. So from what I can see, there have been periodic devastations that have wiped out the human civilizations on Earth. And then people will ask, well, then how do they get started again? And I would say they get started again from the higher levels of the cosmos that aren't affected by these devastations that take place on our level. You have higher intelligences who are able to repopulate the Earth after these periodic devastations that take place.
But they're not totally devastated then. You have some communities, some civilizations that somehow hide, survive. I guess we lucked out.
Yes, or I think it could be that they exist at higher levels of the cosmos, other planets, different systems that aren't affected by the cycles of time that affect us down on our level.
And they somehow reseed us?
Yes, I think that's how it works. That these higher beings reseed the Earth with life forms.
On purpose?
Yes, because there is a purpose for everything. And the purpose is to convince us as conscious beings that this level of reality that we're on now is not our real home. It's temporary.
Right.
It's not where we're meant to be. And therefore, if you look at the great wisdom traditions of the world, all of them, they usually have some system of meditation or yoga or contemplation or some kind of mystical or esoteric discipline that is meant to raise consciousness back to its original level, where it's beyond all the kinds of disturbances that we experience on the level that we find ourselves now.
Michael, if that's possible, let's say that we were seated because they believe, you know, that's their responsibility. Might the ancients of the time have confused those ETs for gods?
Well, I don't think that the two things are mutually exclusive. I think there can be ETs. I think there can also be gods.
I agree.
And so that's one difference I have with some of the researchers
sure.
in this field.
But we're dealing with the interpretation of these primitive people.
Yes, some of them might think like that. You know, just like today, you know, if somebody, you know, goes somewhere with all our advanced technology and communications equipment, they might think, yes, we're gods of some sort. But that doesn't exclude the possibility that there really are gods of the kind that people have always believed in. I think, you know, there could be people like us on other planets that had advanced technologies that allowed them to travel from planet to planet to planet. But to me, that doesn't mean there can't also be higher beings of a more subtle nature that really deserve the name, you know, gods or goddesses and things like that. I think both things actually exist. It seems to me that when many people think about these questions. They're looking for a simple answer of some kind, either a simple creation account where God just, you know, there's one God who just makes everything out of nothing really quick, or a very simple evolution account where life comes from chemicals, the chemicals combine together, they form multicellular organisms, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, human beings, or they're looking for a very simple ET account. But I think the real story is much more complex, and I think it involves all of these things. I think it involves some kind of overall conscious being who's responsible for the whole thing. I think it also has an extraterrestrial element to it, because I think there's life in all planets at all levels of the cosmos. And I think there's also a kind of evolution involved, but not the kind that Darwin talked about, more of an evolution of consciousness, an evolution of the soul passing through different forms of life, becoming more and more aware. So the actual story may be more complex, a more complex but more interesting tapestry than many people now imagine.
Michael, well, we won't have time for another case, but I want to talk, get a few more caseloads. Next hour, we'll also talk about the Vedas. And then with this devolution, is science beginning to agree with this?
Well, yes. I think we have to keep in mind that scientists are not monolithic. I mean, you may have some old fogies out there, strict materialists, reductionists, but you've got a whole new younger generation of scientists in their 20s and 30s with tattoos and body rings and who grew up watching the X-Files on television and listening to Coast to Coast.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the world of science is actually not so monolithic. There is an element there. There is a conservative, reactionary element there, old fogies, who have, you know, these very strict materialistic ideas, and they keep ranting and raving about that. But there are, in the world of science, more open-minded personalities, both younger and older, but especially among the younger generation, who really like ideas of the kind that I'm talking about. I'm regularly invited to speak at conferences on archaeology and anthropology, and especially the younger generation of scientists, they think the kinds of things I'm talking about are very interesting. And, of course, there are some of the old fogies out there who don't like the fact that I'm speaking at the scientific conferences, that I'm getting papers published in scientific journals. But, yes, I think there are scientists who have come around in their thinking to the kinds of ideas that I'm talking about. And, I mean there are some I could name and some I can't name because of their positions, but I would say yes.
The Vedas. That's next with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. And Michael Cremo, our special guest. We're going to take phone calls next hour with Michael. I've got lots more to ask him when we come right back. And welcome back. We're with Michael Cremo. Michael, let's talk about the Vedas, if we can. Explain what they are.
The Vedas are the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. So there are different kinds of Vedas that deal with different topics. I've concentrated on the Puranas, which are the histories. And they tell of human civilizations that have existed on Earth for hundreds of millions of years. And they also explain that humans are not just chemical machines. We are beings of mind, matter, and consciousness, and we originally start out as beings of pure consciousness.
Okay, now, in the Vedas, they talk about incredible flying machines. They talk about what could be a nuclear war. Let's get into that.
Yes, you know, there are two kinds of evidence about the past. One kind of evidence is the kind that we can dig out of the ground, the stones and bones. And the other kind of evidence is the records left by the ancient civilizations themselves. So the Puranas, which are the part of the Vedas that deal with human history, tell us that in the past, and even now, there are Vimanas, which are spacecraft that are capable of traveling from planet to planet. And not only from planet to planet, but through the different levels of the cosmos, there are different kinds of vimanas. Some travel on what we could call the terrestrial level, the level of ordinary matter, where we find ourselves now. Then there are vimanas, or spacecraft, that can travel up into the more subtle level of the cosmos, the level of the more subtle and intellectual energies. And then there are those that can go all the way up to the level of pure consciousness or spirit. And these are described in great detail in these very ancient writings. And they're really quite amazing. These ancient writings also describe weapons that resemble our modern atomic weapons. They were called Brahmastras. And the descriptions of them resemble the explosions of modern nuclear weapons. Actually, Robert Oppenheimer, who was the physicist in charge of the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb in the United States during World War II, was also a student of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. So when the first atomic bomb was tested at Alamogordo in New Mexico, it let off this huge flash of light. And when Oppenheimer experienced that, he began reciting verses from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which describe how the light is like that of millions of suns all put together, which was a perfect description of the atomic blast that he witnessed. And the ancient Sanskrit writings also speak of calculating time according to the movement of atoms, which is something we've just recently rediscovered how to do. You can buy atomic clocks, for example, that set themselves according to the atomic clock that's kept here in the United States. So these writings also gave very detailed descriptions of the development of the embryo in the womb, which is knowledge that didn't really come to the attention of Western scientists until the 16th or 17th century, when they developed microscopes. So these books contain some very, very amazing descriptions of the achievements of these ancient civilizations, who had an understanding not just of how matter works, but how the subtle mind works. There are also descriptions of how to acquire various mystic powers, such as Dur-Darshan, the ability to see at a distance, Dur-Shravana, the ability to hear things that are happening at a great distance. I think a lot of our technology today that we're inventing are just our attempts to recreate things that these ancient civilizations were able to do.
You know, the cases, again, that we talked about, the spheres and issues like that, are truly mind-boggling. There've got to be some more.
Well, yes. I mean, one of the most fascinating cases for me has always been the California gold mine discoveries. We had miners going into the gold mines in California during the gold rush days in the 19th century. And deep inside these tunnels, they were finding human skeletons, human artifacts. And these were collected and reported to the scientific world by Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. His reports were published by Harvard University. So we're not talking about some marginal person. But yeah, we don't hear very much about these discoveries today because of the knowledge filtering process that operates in the world of science. Now, there was another scientist at the time of Whitney. His name was William Holmes. He was an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution. And he said if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have published these reports, which showed evidence for humans existing 50 million years ago at a time when most scientists today think there weren't even any apes or monkeys around at that time. So these are really pretty amazing discoveries. And what I found even more amazing was a few years ago, Bill Cote, who's a television producer in New York, came to me, and he wanted me to participate in a television special that he was producing for NBC called The Mysterious Origins of Man.
Yeah.
And I told him about this case. So he went to the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, because I knew some of the artifacts were still there. But, you know, they refused to allow him to film them. It was really amazing. They're not even shown to the public, but they're still there in that museum. And somehow or other, we were able to find some photographs that Dr. Whitney took of these objects in the 19th century, and those were used for this television special, The Mysterious Origins of Man. But it was really interesting. Scientists in the United States tried to stop NBC from showing that program. And when they were unsuccessful, they went to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and tried to get the FCC to investigate and censure NBC for having, and fine NBC even, for having shown that program. And I'm happy to say the FCC didn't do any of that. But, you know, it was interesting that happened. And oh, and I should say that just recently there's been a re-release on DVD of that television special with a lot of outtakes, like interviews of me that didn't make it into the television program and things like that. But that was a really fascinating case for me, because it just showed not only that this evidence is there, that it's been found, that it's in the scientific literature, that the artifacts are in the museum, but that this knowledge filtering process has been going on for over a century, where scientists just didn't want to accept this evidence because it contradicted their theories, you know, back in the 19th century. And even today, scientists were trying to stop this information from getting out to the people through the media. So I just thought it was a really, you know, fascinating case. And I've actually presented papers about it at major international conferences on archaeology and anthropology, because I think that information, it needs to get out to people in general and also to the scientific community.
Is it possible that somewhere in these ancient records we get information on the Hall of Records at the base of the Sphinx that Edgar Cayce talked about in his trances?
Well, I think it's definitely possible that other civilizations also had repositories of information like that. What I found fascinating about the ancient Sanskrit writings is that their culture has gone on without a break since the ancient times, whereas the Egyptian culture more or less disappeared. The ancient Greek culture, the worshippers of the Greek gods and the Norse gods, that's all gone now, except for a few isolated groups of people that have managed to preserve those teachings. But what I found fascinating about India was that the culture that produced those ancient writings is still there today. It's still existing. The temples are still there. The mystics are there. The yogis are there. It's still all there, basically. So the evidence has basically, the literature, you know, has been, you know, preserved. But I think in other parts of the world, similar repositories of knowledge were there, but have been lost. Some of it, I hope, can be recovered. You know, I think it would just be fantastic if there were a Hall of Records, you know, beneath the Sphinx. Because I think all these ancient civilizations, as far as I can see, they basically had the same concepts. They all accepted that we live in a multi-level cosmos. They all accepted that there's more to a human being than matter. You know, the ancient Egyptians, for example, they had a concept of the soul and the subtle body and the gross physical body. Practically all cultures that I've studied have had that same idea, that we live in a multi-level cosmos inhabited by different kinds of beings existing at different levels, and that a human being is not just a combination of chemicals. None of these ancient wisdom traditions say human beings came from apes and monkeys. They all said that humans are, in one way or the other, to use the Krishna term, made in the image of God, so to speak. So I find that it's as if all these different ancient wisdom traditions were, say, looking at a mountain, but just looking at it from different directions, some looking from the north, from the south, from the east, from the west. So their descriptions are going to be a little bit different, but it's also going to be apparent that they're talking about the same phenomenon. And I found it very interesting that John Mack, who was head of the psychiatry department at Harvard University, became interested in the ancient wisdom traditions through his studies of abductees. He was a psychiatrist at Harvard University. Mm-hmm. He heard about these abduction accounts and
put his career on the line.
Yeah, he put he was one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. We spoke together at a crop circle conference in Glastonbury, England, a few years ago, just before his rather mysterious death in England, which I really don't know what happened. They say he was
hit by a drunk.
I have no idea what really happened. But we had talked. He had come to my lecture. And afterwards, he was talking to me, and I was telling him how much I admired his work. And because in his one of his books, Passport to the Cosmos, he had said, it appears ever more likely that we exist in a multi-level cosmos and that the cosmos is filled with intelligences, gods, spirits, etc., which is exactly my idea as well. So we were talking about that and agreeing to stay in touch with each other. But unfortunately, he was taken from us in this very strange way, and I think it was a great loss, but I think there are researchers who are going to carry on in the same way as I'm also doing. So I think these ideas in these ancient wisdom traditions can help scientists today get a more accurate picture of the kind of world that we actually live in, which is a much stranger world than we get from the picture that's given to us in the textbooks, where all the interesting stuff is left out. The paranormal, the psychical research, reincarnation studies, UFOs, abductees, and all that, it's left out, and I think that's got to change.
Probably will, don't you think?
And I think it is changing. I think gradually it is changing, because I think many scientists really believe in these things, but they're afraid to say it. I mean, I had an experience some years ago. I was invited to speak at the Department of Nuclear Physics at the main science university in Budapest in Hungary. And I was going through what I call the hidden history of physics, which I talk a lot about in my book, Human Devolution. The great physicists who have studied the paranormal, for example, Pierre and Marie Curie, who were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes for their work in discovering radium. It's mm-hmm. something you read about in every physics textbook. What you don't read about in the physics textbook is that the Curies were doing experiments with mediums, and that they had personally done 2 years of experiments with an Italian medium named Eusebio Palladino, and they had become absolutely convinced that there were mystic powers, psychokinesis, the mind over matter abilities. And they had conducted these experiments at the Psychology Institute in Paris. But you don't read about this in your physics textbook. So I went through this and many other cases like that with an audience of about 100 physicists and students of physics, graduate students of physics. And I wondered, well, what are they going to say? So later, one of the physicists came up to me. And he said, by day I do plasma physics. I study the physics of superheated gases. He said, but privately, I'm doing some experiments in telepathy. Yeah, he said, I have my young son, and I put him in another room. I flip a coin, and My son has to guess whether it's heads or tails, and he's getting 80% correct.
That's incredible.
So he said, I would never tell this to my colleagues, but he said, I feel safe in speaking to you about it. And I find this all over the world, that there are many scientists who externally appear quite orthodox in their views, but who privately hold other views. And I think that's something that really can't go on for too much longer. And some of these scientists have now, organized themselves. For example, in this country, we have the Institute for Noetic Sciences, mm-hmm. that was set up by one of our astronauts.
Edgar Mitchell,
right, to investigate, some of these out of bounds topics. There's also in England the Scientific and Medical Network. I've been to Russia. There are organizations of scientists there who are doing research into the paranormal. And you find individual scientists doing this, and plus the fact most ordinary people in the world already accept these things. And that's been shown by Gallup surveys in the United States and elsewhere. Most ordinary people already accept things like telepathy, remote viewing, communications with departed spirits, and things like that. So I think those who are trying in the orthodox scientific circles to impose their limited view of the world on others through the monopoly they now have in the official education system aren't really going to be able to keep it up for too much longer.
Well, that could be. You may be exactly right about that. Michael, where do you get your books and your work?
Well, there are several ways that people can get the books. There's a toll-free number they could call, 888-867-2458. That's 888-867-2458. There's also my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.com. And they could also try their local bookstores. If they don't have it on the shelf, they could certainly order it for them.
Okay, we'll be back with Michael Cremo. We're going to talk a little bit more about the cosmic hierarchy and then your phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM. With our guest, Michael Cremo. So get ready next hour. We'll open up the phone lines. Still a little bit more to chat with him about before we do that on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, was there any information that you might possess or knowledge of about that account of that cave found high up in the Grand Canyon area that might have had Egyptian artifacts in it? Did you hear
A few years ago, George, I got a copy of a newspaper article from the early 20th century that gave an account of how some researchers from the Smithsonian Institution had come to the Grand Canyon region, and they had gone into a certain part of that place and had gone into a cave and had found Egyptian artifacts, a lot of them, quite a number of things. But when I have tried myself to track down the names of the researchers named in that newspaper article, I've kind of drawn a blank. Inquiries to the Smithsonian Institution have drawn a blank. I have met researchers who have told me that there are areas of the Grand Canyon that are blocked off to the public, and I've heard some of them claim that they have had access to that cave, but it's not something I've been able to verify personally myself. So it's one of those cases that I've gotten my files that I have an open mind about, but that I'm not yet ready to say that I'm personally convinced about. When I'm dealing Yeah, with archaeological evidence, as much as possible, I try to verify the evidence myself. For example, those California gold mine discoveries that I was talking about. I mentioned how the television producer, Bill Cote, had not been allowed to see them. But later I went back to that same museum because I had gotten accepted, a paper on those California gold mine discoveries to be presented at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. So I was actually able to get into the museum, go to the storage building where those objects are kept. As I said, they're not shown to the public, and I was able to study and photograph them, and I was able to give my report at the meeting of the World Archaeological Congress. And using information from some of Dr. Whitney's old reports, I was able to go out to the Sierra Nevada mountains and actually locate one of the old 19th century gold mining tunnels where these objects were originally discovered. So generally, that's what I like to try to do, is confirm for myself that the objects exist or the locality exists. So that case from the Grand Canyon that you're talking about, yes, I'm aware of it. Yes, I have looked into it, but I haven't gotten to the point where I've been able to verify these things myself.
I'm told, too, they might have found mummies there, shrines, all kinds of things.
Yes, those things are mentioned in that newspaper article. That's correct.
It might have been 1909.
It's around that time, early 20th century. I don't have it right here in front of me, so I can't give you the exact date on it. But yes, it was from the early 20th century.
Do you believe, because I think the Hopi Indians might have been descendants of Egyptians for some reason. What do you think of that?
I don't know about that personally. I think the idea that there had been contacts among the different civilization centers in the world is something that I find credible. I find it credible that there could have been contact between the Egyptian civilization and the Americas in ancient times. I find that a credible idea. And also, there are apparently some reverse contacts as well. There are some who claim that they have been able to find in Egyptian mummies and things like that, evidence of some remains of American-type plants like tobacco and coca.
Mm-hmm.
It's very controversial. There are some scientists who will poo-poo the evidence.
Didn't they also have corn in some of those sarcophaguses?
Yes. I mean, that's another idea, is that corn is considered to be something that arose in Central America, South America, and that it wasn't present in the Old World until after the time of Columbus. However, there are temples in India that have carvings of gods and goddesses holding ears of corn. You can count the kernels on the corn. You can see that the kernels are arrayed in an irregular fashion, like you see on an ear of corn. And these temple carvings are older than the time of Columbus. They go back hundreds of years before Columbus. So there are evidences like that show that the civilizations in the Old World were in contact with what we call the New World before the time of Columbus. George Carver is an archaeologist who's examined that in quite some detail, and there's some others as well.
Michael, let's talk about cosmic hierarchy here before we get to the top of the hour again. Kind of outline that concept for me.
Well, it appears that we are not alone in the universe. We're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. To me, it appears that the universe is divided, or the cosmos is divided into three basic levels, which can be subdivided into further levels. But basically, there is a level of ordinary matter, which is where we find ourselves now. Beyond that, there is a level of the cosmos dominated by more subtle mental and intellectual energies. It's inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. And, you know, people have had different names for these beings. They've called them gods, goddesses, astral beings, angels, many different names for them. And then beyond that, I think there's a level of the cosmos dominated by pure consciousness. And that's where we originally come from, I believe. Now, some will ask, first of all, I should point out that this is something that you can find in practically every wisdom tradition of the world, you know, if you look at their writings. In my book, Human Devolution, I have a chapter called The Cross-Cultural Study of Cosmologies, where I look at 25 or 30 different cultures, widely separated in time and space, that all have this same concept, that we exist at a multi-level cosmos inhabited by beings at the different levels. Now, some people, scientists and others, will tell me, well, it's very interesting that these ancient books of knowledge talk about that, but what kind of evidence is there today that we can see that would lead us to believe, yeah, we exist in a multi-level cosmos with beings existing at different levels and things of that? And I think there are five or six different categories of evidence that would suggest that. One is communications that people living on our level, humans living on Earth, receive from spirits of departed humans. I think another category of such evidence is possession of humans living on our Earth by spirits of humans who have departed our world. Then I think we also have the phenomenon of apparitions of spirits of departed humans. These have been witnessed by many people. Then we have the phenomenon of possession of humans existing on our Earth by spirits that appear to be of not just of ordinary people that have left, but of supernatural types of beings. And then we also have the modern UFO alien abduction kinds of events. And then we also have apparitions of superhuman beings. And these have been reported by many people. For example, there's a case of spirit possession that was mentioned in a textbook of psychology written by William James, the father of modern psychology. It's called The Watsika Wonder. It's about a girl who took birth in a family living in the town of Watsika in the state of Illinois mm-hmm. in the 19th century. Her name was Lorancy Venom. And she lived a quite ordinary life until one day she started going into trance states. And in these trance states, she encountered spirits of different departed humans, and one of them was a girl, the spirit of a girl named Mary Roth. And she said, I'd like to come and visit my parents and visit my family. And after that happened, then this girl, Lorancy Venom, she no longer felt at home with her own family. She didn't recognize them anymore. So some of her family members went and found this Roth family, and they brought the members of this Roth family to the Venom house. When Lorancy, the girl, saw them coming up to the house, she immediately recognized them. That's my mother, that's my sister, that's my father. So both families agreed that Lorancy should go and live with the Roth family. And she did that for several months, and she behaved perfectly like their daughter. She displayed intimate knowledge of confidential details of the family history that would have only been known to this girl, Mary Roth. So she went on like that for several months until, again, she started going into trance states. And the spirit of Mary Ross said, okay, now I've seen my family. I'm going to go back to where I was. So after that happened, Lorancy Venom no longer felt at home with the Roth family. She didn't know where she was. She didn't recognize anybody. So both families agreed she should go back to her original family. Now, what I find interesting about this case is that it was mentioned by William James, the father of modern psychology, as a genuine case of spirit possession in his textbook, Principles of Psychology. So it was a very, very interesting case. And then we've also have cases like the case of Oliver Lodge, who was a very famous physicist who lived in England early in the 20th century. He had a son named Raymond who was killed in Europe during World War I. After that happened, Lodge went to a medium, and he was in disguise. He didn't say who he was. He had no previous contact with this woman whatsoever. And in the course of the seance with this medium, they established communication with the spirit of a person who appeared to be Raymond, the son of Lodge, and who communicated through the medium all kinds of information that would have only been known to Raymond and not to anyone else. So Lodge was convinced that he had established contact with the spirit of his son, and they gave many other tests over a few years in which this conclusion seemed to be pretty certainly established. And Lodge wrote a book about it, which I find very interesting because it was written by a professional scientist, a very prominent physicist, and it went over all the kinds of skeptical objections that could be given to these kinds of things. So, and then we could also consider the modern UFO alien types of experiences and some other types of experiences that people have in this world, apparitions, for example. Scientists have reported apparitions of departed humans. So I think there is evidence that we can observe today that would lead us to conclude that, yes, we are part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings.
A planned part.
Yes. And the plan, I think, is that we are here now. And we feel uncomfortable because naturally we are meant to be beyond birth and death, beyond all the kinds of changes and disturbances that we experience here. That's why we feel uncomfortable here. And that should be an impetus for us to try to raise our consciousness back to its original state, its original level, which is beyond all these things that go on at these lower levels of this cosmic hierarchy of beings. And I think that's why all the great spiritual traditions of the world have different systems of meditation, yoga, contemplation that are meant to help us do that, restore consciousness to its original pure state. By devolution, I mean the process by which a conscious self departs from its original position and becomes covered by the lower energies, enters into the lower regions of the cosmos, and becomes covered by the lower energies of mind and matter.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it is necessary for those who make the choice to come here, and anyone who wants to remain here can. That's their choice. But it seems most of us begin to experience some kind of sense of discomfort or dissatisfaction with our existence on this level of reality. Somehow we feel limited. We feel pushed by the forces of time. We don't want to become older, but we become older. These are all things that affect the vehicle that we're in now. Just like you might have a car, The car may become older, it may break down, and then you may have to get another one. But you're different than the vehicle, different than the car. So similarly, I think as conscious cells, we're different than the material bodies that we are now finding ourselves in, with all their limitations and discomforts and dissatisfactions. So I would say that should be an impetus to restore consciousness to its original pure state. Now, there are different systems for doing that. I mean, I have a personal meditation that I engage in, but I think everyone should look for what works for them.
What pushed you to these conclusions, Michael?
Well, yeah, when I think about it, when I really think about it, I think it's something that I started in some past life. I really do believe in reincarnation. I think, for example, I've always wanted to be a writer. Even as a small child, I wanted to write. I was always writing, reading. Why? I think it's something I started in some past life. Otherwise, I think it's very difficult to explain the kinds of extraordinary talents, that some people exhibit. Some very young children, they can compose music, they can play piano concertos, or else they can do very complicated mathematics or speak many different languages. I think there's a lot of evidence that this isn't our first life. I think we go through many different lives on this level of reality. So I think it's something I started in some past life, and that in this life, when the opportunities to continue my spiritual development have presented themselves to me, I've taken them up. I've taken them up and tried to make further progress on that long road back to the original position of pure consciousness. And one thing we see about consciousness is individual and personal. And that suggests to me there's a source of all conscious beings that's also individual and personal. So on that level of pure consciousness, it's not that we would just merge into oneness. We'd all still remain individuals, but we'd exist in harmony with each other and with the source of all conscious beings. And I think that's what we really want in this world. We want to get over all the things that divide us and draw us into conflict and competition.
Michael Cremo, Lynn McTaggart would call this the force. We'll be back with Michael Cremo and your phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The hour you've been waiting for, a discussion with Michael Cremo with your phone calls. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Michael Cremo, our special guest, and your phone calls as well. Michael, what's next for you? I know I ran into you in San Jose. How many conferences are you going on?
Well, the next thing I have up is an Earth Transformation Conference that's being held on the Big Island in Hawaii in May. And then after that, in late June, early July, I'll be speaking at the World Archaeological Congress meetings in Dublin, Ireland. The World Archaeological Congress is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists, so I'll be presenting two papers at that conference. I've got my scientific audience, and then I've got my general public kind of audience, and I try to stay in touch with both of them. Later in the year, I'll be doing another lecture tour of Russia. I caused such a big stir there, they want me to come back, so we'll see what happens with that.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, thank you very much,
sure thing.
George and Michael. I appreciate your topic. And, Michael, I had a question for you as far as these artifacts in these digs and things like that. What type of radiometric dating method was used to determine the age of the find?
It depends on how old they are. A lot of people are familiar with the radiocarbon method, carbon-14 method, but that only works back about 50,000 to 100,000 years. And most of the things I'm talking about are far older than that. We're talking about things that go back millions of years. So when you get back that far in time, there aren't any methods that you could use that could directly date the artifacts or bones themselves. You know, for example, if today scientists find a dinosaur bone, there's nothing that they can use to date the bone itself. It's too old. So what they have to do is they have to use methods that will date the age of the layer of the rock in which the bone is found. So when you get back to millions of years, that's what you have to do. So what I have relied on is modern geological reports about the ages of the formations in which these very ancient footprints or human bones or human artifacts are found. And these may include the potassium-argon method, which is used for dating volcanic deposits, for example. There are cases where we have human bones or human artifacts being found in layers of volcanic ash. For example, the human footprints that were found at Laetoli in the country of Tanzania by Mary Leakey were found in layers of solidified volcanic ash that were dated using the potassium-argon method as being 3,700,000 years old. So when you get back to millions of years, which is the age of most of the discoveries that I'm talking about, there aren't methods that will date the object or footprint or bone itself. You have to use methods that will date the layers of rock in which the artifact or bone or footprint is found.
So this with like the potassium 40 and to argon 40, is that one discussing
that? Yes, that's one, or a more recent version of that is the argon-argon method that dates, you know, the ratio of isotopes of argon gas of these volcanic crystals. There are also different radiometric methods involving uranium, selenium, different radioactive elements that allow geologists to get ages of layers of other kinds of rock than the volcanic rocks that the potassium-argon or argon-argon method is generally used for.
There was a study, some French paleontologists, this is about 30 years ago, they've done the carbon-14 dating on a saber-toothed tiger bone, and they got a very strong carbon reading from the bone, and then they were surprised because by that time, the half-life was estimated to be 5,730-year half-life of the decay rate of the carbon decaying back by a beta decay process back to nitrogen-14 originally, where it was formed in the upper atmosphere. But they were surprised by that finding. So they then proceeded to do a test on 15,000 fossils, including dinosaur fossils, and they've got carbon-14 readings from every one of these finds, up to 15,000 fossils that they measured with very strong carbon-14 ratings, and they were just amazed at the findings because up to beyond 40 to 50,000 year range, after that there would be no carbon left that would give any measurable reading, but they had found very strong readings in all these bones. And then they also determining the Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Libby, in 1945, that came up with the method of dating the bones through the carbon-14, is a 25% discrepancy between the nitrogen-14 becoming carbon-14 in the upper atmosphere to the decay rate in the organism as the organism took in the carbon-14 by either the plant or the animal eating the plant or the animal eating the animal that ate the plant. Then once the animal died, it stopped taking in the carbon-14, and it began to decay back into the nitrogen-14s. That's how the method works. But they, what would you think about that, where they got...
Well, here's what I'd say about that. In the work that I'm trying to do, it doesn't necessarily depend on me accepting the dating methods as accurate. What I'm doing is I'm putting questions to scientists who accept the Darwinian theory of evolution. And my question is this. According to methods that you consider reliable, you know, the age of this formation is so and so many millions of years. So how do you explain the presence in these layers of rock of this human bone or this human artifact or this human footprint? Now, you have to have some framework for discussion. So the framework for discussion that I'm using is the methods that these scientists who accept the Darwinian theory of evolution consider accurate: radiocarbon dating, potassium argon dating, uranium series dating, so on and so forth. So my question to them is, all right, how do you explain the presence of these human bones, human artifacts, or human footprints in layers of rock that, according to methods you consider reliable, are so-and-so many millions of years old? So either they have to admit that their dating methods are completely inaccurate, which means they can't say how old anything is, which means they can't arrange things in any kind of sequence, which means they can't support their theories. Or they have to admit that their theories are wrong. You know, so either way, I win. And my method of argument doesn't depend on me accepting their dating methods as accurate. Now, I tend to think that the dating methods are based on some kind of sound principles, the known rates of decay of radioactive elements. And I would say that in any particular case, the methods could be wrong because of, for example, of contamination of samples. It may be possible that, say if you have a human bone that's really 5 million years old, and you do a radiocarbon test on it, and it shows the presence of some carbon-14 in it. Well, that would mean the bone would have to be less than 100,000 years old for it to show any carbon-14 in it whatsoever. So how could that happen? Well, say if you have a human bone that's really 5 million years old, and then it gets contaminated with the least bit of modern carbon-14, which could enter the bone through bacteria, from organic material in groundwater, from organic preservatives that might have been applied to the bone, from even touching it. Even if a human being just touches it, that could result in some carbon, rubbing off from the human skin cells and getting into the bone somehow. And if that were detected, even if the bone was 5 million years old, if it was contaminated with the least bit of modern carbon, it would show, an age of 100,000 years or less. So one has to be careful about all these things. But my basic method is it doesn't depend on the accuracy of these dating methods that I accept them, because I'm engaged in a discussion with scientists who do accept these dating methods. So my method is to say, okay, according to methods that you consider reliable, here's the age of these formations. Then my question is, how do you explain the presence of this human bone, this human artifact, or this human footprint in those layers of rock that, according to your dating methods, are tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of years old? Either they have to say their dating methods are wrong, which is fine with me, or they have to admit their theory of evolution is wrong. Either way, I win.
Let's go west of the Rockies, Chula Vista. Ken, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George, I want to congratulate you on your choice of guest tonight. And Michael Cremo, I want to congratulate you on your seminal work, Forbidden Archaeology.
Thank you.
It is one day you will be recognized, I hope, for the great contribution that you've made. I just wanted to comment on... point you were making earlier about Darwin and the essentially religious nature of the theory of organic evolution. And it's singular impermeability to facts. I mean, you have assembled here in this lengthy book example after example and a great deal of evidence that is completely contradictory to Darwinian ideas. And it's amazing, I think, to look at what you've done in your book in the light of history, because it was certainly known to Darwin himself before he wrote The Origin that his system, his theory, was already contradicted by known facts. He expressed these doubts time and again in a letter to Asa Gray. He talked about his doubts concerning the evolutionary development of the human eye. And he also said in The Origin itself, in the book that he had written, that his theory would absolutely break down if sufficient counterexamples could be given in the fossil record. But the thing is, in his time, he already knew that it was deficient. Agassiz, contemporaries, great scientific contemporaries like Agassiz and Cuvier had already noted the lack of transition in the fossil record. The kinds of fossils that Darwin's theory predicted were simply not there. And it was already apparent in Darwin's day that they were not going to be found. And the persistence of this theory in science is mystifying, because science is supposed to be objective, experimental, and Darwinians are anything but, as you have yourself experienced in your career. I mean, the people have rejected your ideas, mainstream geology, paleontology, biology, for no good reason other than the fact that they have a metaphysical religious worldview dictated by this Darwinian outlook.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. The metaphysical worldview that they have, it involves a very strict materialism where you have only ordinary matter operating according to known physical laws. And they have made it a principle that you cannot invoke any kind of intelligent action, entities that are more subtle or that involve vital principles or consciousness existing apart from matter or anything like that. They've made that a rule, but that's sort of something that's come about very recently in science. If you trace the history of science back to the time of Darwin and before, even in the West, there were many scientists who, even at the time of Darwin, were invoking different kinds of Platonic principles of forms existing at higher levels that are reflected in ordinary matter, or they had ideas about life that involved vital principles, subtle principles, consciousness existing apart from matter, things like that. But what happened was is that in sometime between the time of Darwin and World War I, basically, science changed very radically. And what they did is they eliminated all of these other kinds of principles, vitalistic principles, consciousness, higher intelligences being involved in the production of life forms and things like that. They found, although Darwin himself really wasn't like that, they found Darwinism to be a very perfect vehicle for maintaining this very strict atheism and materialism in the world of science. And so that's what the world of science is today. But I think it's a modern myth that, say, science and religion, God and science, are two different things. I mean, even Darwin mentioned the creator being involved in the origin of life in his book, Origin of Species. So if you want to say you have to have a strict separation between God and science, then the first person we have to remove from the science curriculum would be Charles Darwin in his theory of evolution, because in his book, Origin of Species, he mixes God and science quite clearly. So, I mean, especially in the Origin of Species went through 6 editions, and from the second edition to the last edition, he mentions the Creator with a capital C being involved in the origin of life. So I think he wasn't as strict as many of his followers today are in trying to make this strict separation between, you know, God and science, religion and science, that's now been enshrined in laws and things like that. So, but I agree with you that his modern followers, you know, have, you know, kind of turned, you know, Darwinism into an ideology, a kind of religion that can't be challenged, even by numerous facts and failures of explanation. Nobody's been able to explain on the genetic level exactly how you go from a creature that doesn't have an eye to a creature that does have a developed eye. I mean, we're told, well, there's a long series of genetic changes that took place that gradually led to the formation of the eye. But if we ask, what is that series of genetic changes, they can't tell us.
Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with Michael Cremo on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, The Escapades of Time Traveler John Teeter with webmaster Oliver Williams, a program you've asked for, and we've got it. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo. Your final questions. David in British Columbia, you're on the air with Michael Cremo. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Happy Equinox, Michael and George.
Thank you.
And I got, a couple of questions, one about the Vedas and one biblical. I want to ask Michael his opinion. I always thought when I read in the Vedas about the in and out breaths of Brahma that it was talking about the, we always hear about the Big Bang, start of the universe, but I think the Vedas talk about this as a recurring cyclical process, that the Big Bang is like he breathes out, and then we're kind of, scientists are wondering if the universe is expanding or beginning to collapse, and I think when it does collapse, that's the in-breath, and when he breathes out, that's the Big Bang, goes over and over. And kind of the biblical one, I was wondering about, it's, Adam and Eve get booted out of the garden, and it talks about them putting on animal skins, and I think that's talking about them putting on a physical body, and it kind of talks about the devolution Mike was talking about.
I think that last idea of yours is very, very interesting, and I think that would be really great if you could develop that. It sounds like a really good idea. I do find in practically all spiritual traditions, all wisdom traditions, the idea that we have devolved from some higher position, and we're meant to go back to that. So I think your insight on that sounds very interesting. The first part of your question about the Vedic ideas about cyclical manifestation of the universes, I think you're absolutely right about that. I talk about that in my book, Human Devolution, on the section on cosmology. And as you mentioned, today many scientists have the idea that the universe started out as a small point, and it began to expand at a very rapid rate, and now the expansion, they believe, has slowed down, so that they think eventually things are going to reverse and the universe will stop expanding. Some cosmologists think that, and that it will go back again to a small point. Also, many cosmologists today have the idea that there are many universes, and these are both ideas, you know, that we find in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which tell us that there's a a manifestation of God called Mahavishnu that lies on a causal ocean. Of course, this causal ocean is kind of interesting. It's reminiscent of the quantum mechanical vacuum that cosmologists today talk about as the source of all creation. They compare it to a sea of seething energy, you know, from which universes are being manifested. So in the Vedic version, this Mahavishnu is lying on that causal ocean, and when he breathes out, numerous universes, many universes, come from the pores of the Mahavishnu, and they begin to expand. And then when he breathes in again, they are reabsorbed. So many scientists today, they think universes come from black holes and are reabsorbed into these black holes after some time. So there are a lot of parallels between modern cosmology and the cosmology that we find described in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. So thank you for bringing those two things up.
Okay, next up, Wildcard Line. Hi there, you're on the air with us.
Yeah, this is my name is Brett, calling from Lima, Ohio.
Hey, Brett, thanks.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Hi, George.
Hi, Brett.
My first time calling. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, I got a friend who believes the Earth and the universe is only like 7,000 to 10,000 years old.
Yep, the new creationists. They are.
What's that?
They're the new creationists, they believe.
Yeah, I wanted to see what your idea is. As a matter of fact, somebody was on with George, yep. I believe, a couple weeks ago.
Dr. Walt Brown.
Okay, yeah, and I listened to that, and man, I want to call in real bad because he seemed kind of argumentative, I guess, but I want to see what your thoughts are on that.
Well, here's what I think about it. Among the biblical creationists, there are two types. One is called the short earth creationist, and then there's the long earth creationist. So the short earth creationists, they accept an age for the earth of 10,000 years or less, maybe 7,000 years, like you say. The long earth Christian creationists, they accept a long age for the earth in billions of years, as I do.
That's what I think, too.
So now, for my friends who are in the short earth category, what I tell them is whether we believe the earth is a few billion years old or a few thousand years old, humans have been around since the beginning. And at least we can agree on that. So that much we would agree on. We would disagree about the age of the earth. So that's how I deal with those folks. They generally have a harder time with the dating methods than I do, because many of the dating methods that scientists today use give ages for the earth going back hundreds of millions, billions of years. I don't have as much of a problem with the dating methods as they would, because they would have to show that all of those dating methods are wrong and everything's less than 10,000 years old, which I don't agree with.
Right. Cool. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to our next wildcard line. Ed Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, I was wondering. I got two questions, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on. You said that we've done this around six times, that man has been created and went into technology, then destroyed himself, and then we've done this six times, I guess?
Yes. In the current creation cycle, I would say yes. Now, this is based on an understanding that I've gotten from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, that time goes in vast cycles. And the basic unit of this cyclical time is called the Kalpa, or the Day of Brahma. It lasts about 4,320,000,000 years. It's followed by a night of Brahma that lasts the same amount of time, about 4 billion years. And the days and nights go in cycles endlessly. So during the days of Brahma, life is manifest in the universe, and in the nights, it's not manifest. So according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, the day of Brahma that we're in now began about 2 billion years ago. And therefore, from that standpoint, I would expect the earliest signs of life on Earth to go back about 2 billion years. Now, it's interesting that according to modern paleontology, the oldest signs of life, undisputed signs of life, go back about 2 billion years. Now since this day of Brahma is divided into sub-cycles called Manvantara periods, each one lasting about 300 million years. According to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in the seventh of these Manvantara periods. That means there have been six before us. And after each one, there is a devastation, a catastrophe that wipes out life on Earth, and after which the Earth has to be repopulated. Now, I find it interesting that according to modern paleontology, you've got basically the same picture. Life begins on Earth about 2 billion years ago, and then there have been six major extinction events, according to modern paleontologists, in the history of life on Earth since it began about 2 billion years ago. And these extinction events are spaced at intervals of several hundred million years. So there's some interesting parallels between what modern paleontology says about the history of life on Earth and what the ancient Sanskrit writings of India say about the history of life on Earth. So that's a little bit of elaboration on that topic.
Okay, let's go to East of the Rockies. Michael, you're on the air with Michael Cremo.
It's Michael in Denton, Texas.
Sure.
Excellent show.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, I have three quick questions, and I'll listen off the air. I'm not going to begin to try to pronounce the words, but in order to see things and hear things at a distance, would it be advantageous or better to adopt a vegetarian or vegan diet? And who would the Celtic Brahma be, if there is one? And third, if you're familiar with a very general Vedic astrology, or if you're familiar with Vedic astrology, a general Vedic question is, do you think that prayer can override the limitations when it's in one's birth chart, or is the Navamsha what it is, and prayer is included in the outcome of a life? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay, so these are some pretty technical questions. I'll start from the last one. I do believe in astrology. I do believe that there is something called karma that determines the history of a person's life, based on their past activities and past lives, but I think it can be overcome by different spiritual practices, including prayer and things like that, that destroy the karma. If you destroy the karma that's there, then that means your fate has changed. For example, if you have some seeds that are meant to sprout and grow up and produce different fruits, if somehow or other you, say, fry the seeds, then they're not going to germinate, and they're not going to produce the fruits that would have been expected. So I think this phenomenon of karma is there. It's written in the stars, but it's possible to overcome it. It's possible to get rid of the karma by different systems of meditation, yoga, prayer, contemplation, things like that. The second question about
Brahma,
a Celtic Brahma.
Mm-hmm.
I think in almost every spiritual tradition, you've got the idea of a creator god. I don't know the one in the Celtic, what the exact name for that Celtic figure would be, but in, you know, the Australian Aboriginal tradition, they have it. In ancient Greek philosophy, they had it. Plato had the idea that there's a supreme god and then a demiurge, he called, who would be a creator god. Because the supreme god really doesn't have too much to do with matter. So there would be some other creator god who has something to do with the structure of the universe and the origin of the life forms in it. And then going back to the first question, I wrote it down. But
vegan diet? Or?
Oh, okay. That would be whether developing paranormal powers would be helped by a vegan diet. I think, yes, putting oneself into a position where one is causing the least amount of violence to other living things as possible would be a way of sensitizing one's consciousness so that it would be able to experience these things. I think these are abilities that we all have. You know, I can recall going to a conference where there was another speaker there. I spoke, and then Stephen Schwartz spoke. Now, Stephen Schwartz is someone who was connected with the remote viewing project that the U.S. military engaged in few years back. And he was pointing out that this remote viewing, or Durdarshan ability, we would call it in Sanskrit, is something that we all have. And he demonstrated that. He held a workshop at this conference, and I participated in it. It was a remote viewing workshop. And what he did was, there were about 100 of us there, and he selected three people. He asked them to go in a car to any place they wanted in the city where we were within a 15-minute driving radius. And then he asked them to go to that place and then try to mentally send the imagery back to us who were waiting, you know, at the conference hall, and also to videotape the exact place that they were at and then bring the videotape back. So while they were gone, going to the place, we were guided into putting ourselves into a very relaxed state, and we were told to accept the imagery that came to our minds and record it. So the first image that came to my mind was candles, like glass, red glass candles with flames, you know, inside them. And I had a very elaborate vision of a church and, you know, all different kinds of features of it. And then when the group came back from the place where they were, they put the videotape in the machine, they played it. The first image that came up was this bank of candles, like these red glass candles. So, and it was really pretty amazing. I think this remote viewing is something that we all have, but we're not, just not used to using it. And I think it is helped by a diet, meditation, different lifestyle choices that we make.
Let's go to our last caller, first-time caller. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Well, I wanted to say thank you for having your guest on.
You're welcome.
Absolutely great.
He's the best.
George, I also want to say thank you for being my companion. I just started a new job, and I listen to you every overnight shift.
Great. You help me immensely. Glad to be along the trip with you.
Yes. So my question, actually, is as far as Christianity goes and the subject figure of Jesus, you had talked about, you know, different almost planes of existence where, you know, there's this, a hierarchy, if that was how you put it. Where does, you know, the figurehead of Jesus fit into that? You know, basically a man that could perform these miracles and could do all of these wonderful things, but yet he was still a man.
1 minute, Michael.
I think he was a being that came from the higher level, originally pure consciousness, existing in harmony with the source of all conscious beings, who we could call God, if you like. And he descended to the lower levels of the cosmos to give us information about what our real home was and that we should go back there. And I think there are many avatars and bodhisattvas and others who have descended from those higher levels to give us these kinds of messages.
Michael Cremo, my friend, thanks so much for being on the program. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
And his work, of course, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Don't forget John Teeter on our next program. For Wayne Roberts, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.